Okay, so I think we can probably start. So tonight's talk is going to be on the concept of freedom, the idea of freedom, what freedom is all about, and specifically, of course, about freedom in Buddhism, of course, and how freedom in Buddhism compares to freedom, that the ideas of freedom that we normally use to in our society, in our contemporary secular society, how we regard freedom, and how these two concepts compare with each other. And of course, no surprise, of course, the idea of freedom in Buddhism, of course, is much more profound and much more meaningful than the kind of ideas that we have in ordinary society about what freedom is about. But I think it's useful to compare these ideas, to give that contrast, and then get a deeper understanding of what these things are, perhaps. But of course, the word freedom, or the idea of freedom, is a very kind of positive idea, right? When people think freedom, they think something very good, something very nice. The first thing that comes to mind when you think of freedom often is freedom from not being in jail, right? When you are in jail, you are definitely not free. You are behind steel bars and concrete and all these kind of things. And that is kind of the opposite of freedom, right? Of course, the reason why it's opposite of freedom is because you are hindered, you're obstructed from doing what you want to do in life. You can't go here, you can't go there. And this is one of the kind of main things throughout life, that the hindrances and obstructions in life are the things that kind of stop us from feeling free. Whenever there's a hindrance somewhere, whenever there's an obstruction, that is a kind of thing that stops us. We can't do what we want, right? We can't express ourselves because of these things. So hindrances and obstructions is one of those things. And this is, again, in ordinary society, how we often look at these things. And another thing which stops our freedom, perhaps, in ordinary life and whatever, is the feeling of being oppressed, right? If you feel oppressed by, whether it's by a government or by a group of people or a boss at work or a family member or a bully or whatever it is, that oppression also is a lack of freedom. You can't really express yourself because you are psychologically, confined by that oppression around you. So these are some of the aspects of why this idea of freedom has such positive connotation in our lives. There's no hindrances, there's no oppression, and because of that, we are free to express ourselves. We're free to follow our desires, free to do, basically, to choose as we want and as we like in life. And this is what Ajahn Brahm often talks about, right? The freedom of choice, or the freedom of desire. This is like the highest sense in which we are considered free often in contemporary society, contemporary secular society. And you can see that on so many levels, right? If you look at our society in so many ways, is it about that? You look at the political systems that we have. The political systems are often built up around this idea of freedom from desire, freedom from oppression, and being able to express ourselves. One example of that, for example, would be something like Marxism, right? Marxism was developed in the 19th century, and the idea there by Karl Marx was to kind of free the workers from the oppression of society, or oppression of people who were exploiting them and these kind of things. Again, you wanted to free yourself from these problems that society had inflicted on the large number of people. So even our political systems, everything is built up around these ideas of freedom. And capitalism is in many ways a similar kind of thing. Capitalism, which is sort of perhaps the kind of the background ideology behind most societies, certainly in the West these days. It's not maybe a perfect ideology or a perfect idea of capitalism. Anyway, the idea there is somehow the idea of freedom, right? You give out the money, all the all the means of production in society are owned by private interests. The private interests compete with each other, right? And the idea is that you create more wealth. The economy grows as a consequence of these things. And when the economy grows, the pie that we can share is larger, right? And when the pie that we can share is larger, we can spend more money, each one of us. When you can spend more money, you can express yourself more in so many different ways, whether it's through the arts or through just through your desires or whatever it is. You can express yourself in these ways. And it's funny, I read in the newspapers about, economic things. And the economy, sometimes people are lamenting the economy isn't growing as fast as it used to. Last year it was 3%. This year it's only 2%, right? And I find it so absurd sometimes. You read about these things in the paper, and people are kind of discussing back and forth. How can we kind of get the economy back on track again? It's only growing 2%, maybe next year only 1%. And this year, last year it was 3%. What are we going to do about this? It's terrible, right? And for myself, it seems so, it seems so strange to think like that. Whether the economy grows by 3% or 2%, whether that is something that really needs to be discussed up and down, and somehow what can we do to get this back on track again? And then we have all these institutions, the central bank, right, tries to kind of correct the interest rate in the right way, and then they do these things where they kind of inject more money into the economy to get it growing again. And everybody's discussing how we can avoid, problems and deflation, and they compare us to China. China is growing much faster. We are growing more slowly. What's going to happen? And I think to anybody who has a little bit of spiritual inclination, it feels kind of a little bit, maybe not complete, but a little bit, so what? What's the big deal whether the economy is growing at 2% or 3%? Right? It seems sort of, okay, of course, probably maybe it's better if it grows a bit faster, but at the end of the day, does it really matter so much? And of course, the answer is, the reason why it matters so much is because our expression, our understanding of freedom in society has to do with our ability to choose and to spend. That is what freedom is in our contemporary society. It's about the ability to go out there, to spend more money than we had last year, to choose things we haven't chosen before, to express ourselves in ways that we haven't expressed ourselves before, whatever way that might be. So, of course, these things, they are narrowed down when the economy isn't growing so fast. And that is why people are in such great despair when the economy goes down, right? Because this is freedom for us, for large parts of the population. Not if you have a spiritual inclination, perhaps, but certainly if you live in ordinary society. So it may seem funny, it may seem strange when you sit in your little hut as a monk in the forest, and you think about this. It seems really weird. But actually, it is a serious matter if you buy into the ordinary understanding of what freedom is all about. So this is one thing. Our society is built for this, right? It's built around this idea of freedom. Because it is built around that, it means that we tend to pursue those things. And one way, of course, that we pursue those things is by making money, right? We go out into the world, we want to make money, and of course, the more money we can make, the more we can spend, the more we can express ourselves, the more we can choose, the more we can fulfill everything we want in life. Money is one of the key means of enabling that freedom of choice that is so hallowed in our society. So we go out and we try to make money, right? And what happens when you try to make money? What happens is that often you butt up against other people because other people are also trying to make money. And sometimes you compete for the same contract. You compete for the same job, which is well-paying. We start competing with each other. And sometimes the competition is unfair, right? The person who was clueless, didn't really know what they were doing, they got the job. Whereas, I'm doing the right thing. And I didn't get this job, and I should have had it. They didn't. And when we have competition, when we have this fight over limited resources, because there's always going to be limited resources, limited money to go around, a limited economy, when we fight over this, when we compete over this, there's going to be friction, right? There's going to be anger, there's going to be irritation, sometimes there's going to be violence, because violence is rooted in anger and the problems that come from these kind of things. And this is one of those basic teachings, actually a very important teaching of the Buddha, is this, that when you have the search for choice, the search for enjoying yourself in the world, the search for expressing yourself, for making choices, for accumulating things, whatever it is, one of the consequences of that is always violence. It's always anger. It is always conflict. It is always problems. You can't have this craving, this desire, this search for, you know, expressing ourselves in whatever way. You can't have that without violence. Violence goes hand in hand with that. So craving, desire, always must go hand in hand with violence. And that is one of the terrible things about it, right? Straight away, you can see that this ideal that we have, this ideal of freedom of choice, freedom of expressing ourselves, even if we do that in a way where we don't hurt others directly, of course, that's the only right way of doing it. Even if we don't do that, still it must lead to violence. Still it must lead to problems. So this is the first problem that with this idea that we have of freedom of expression, the first problem is that it is intertwined, interconnected. It cannot be separated from the problems of anger and violence in society. Very interesting, I think a very powerful insight of the Buddha. It's explained in many places in the discourses. And of course it gets worse, because if we really want to pursue freedom of choice and freedom for ourselves to what to do, one of the things that people always want is power. We want to have power, because power is one of the things that enables us to express ourselves. Once you have power, you can have the ability to basically use that power in such a way that you gain advantage. That's what power is about, right? In subtle ways. You may not do it deliberately to hurt others, but it tends to go that way. Power is very dangerous. Power corrupts, right? This ancient, not ancient perhaps, but this well-known kind of psychological effect of power. Power corrupts, and because it corrupts, we use that power for our own advantage. There is a problem again. The problem again, it leads to conflict. It leads to my desires, my cravings over somebody else's. That is what power is all about. And again, it leads to conflict. And it's natural. As long as there is craving, as long as there is a desire to express ourselves, the search for power is just behind it. Because power is what enables us to take that to its highest possible level. So again, this is the first point. Violence and craving are two sides of the same coin. But it's much worse than this. That is only the kind of the beginning why this kind of freedom doesn't really work. I'll just bring you back to the beginning. I'm talking about freedom here, the idea of freedom of choice, right? Freedom of expression, etc. But this gets much worse than that. And to give you some idea of what I... how bad it can get. I want to do a little thought experiment with you here. And this is the experiment of think, we now live in a society where there is a fair amount of freedom, right? We can choose a lot more in terms of indulgences, in terms of material well-being, in terms of expressing ourselves in various ways, much, much more today than we could say 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, let alone 200 or 300 years ago, right? We have kind of expanded our horizons. We have much more freedom. There's less interference in our lives than there was in the old days when kings and governments might kind of be much more oppressive and all these kind of things. So we're kind of moving in that direction, which probably is a good thing, right? That is a good thing to have that kind of freedom. But my thought experiment is, if we move this further, if we take this to the extreme, where does it lead? And where it leads, if we take it to the extreme. So today we are much more able to satisfy our desires than we were before, much more quickly, right, than we were before. So the extreme of this, if we keep on moving in this direction, this is just a thought experiment, this is not reality. If we take it to the extreme, all our desires at the extreme, could be fulfilled, might be fulfilled instantaneously, right? That is kind of directions you're moving into. Everything you want, straight away, it is satisfied, right? This is taking this whole idea where we're moving to an extreme. Now, what do you think about that? Would that be a nice thing? If as soon as you had a craving, okay, I'd like to eat this, straight away, you were satisfied, right? As soon as you had some kind of idea, I'm gonna make a beautiful piece of art, and you have this idea in your head, and what are you gonna paint? Straight away, there it is, it's done. You have this, this person that you're very interested in, this relationship you like to get into. Straight away, there they are. They are your boyfriend or girlfriend, right? Or whatever you desire in life, whatever you want, straight away the desire is fulfilled. That is kind of the optimizing what we're doing already. That's taking it to the extreme, right? This is just to get some feeling for whether we're heading in the right direction or not. That's why I'm saying these things. But what is that like if everything straight away is satisfied? What would it feel like? And I say what it would feel like, it would feel terrible. It sounds like some kind of ideal, perhaps, but I think it's an absolute nightmare if everything is straight away satisfied. And the reason for that is because for the vast majority of people, the whole purpose of life is that striving, is that craving, is that doing which moves you towards those goals in life, right? This is what it's about. We identify with that doing. We are that doing. We identify with the craving itself. We are the craving. Take away that distance between you and where you want to be and narrow it down to nothing so that you have everything straight away. Then your sense of identity of who you are, or the very purpose of life, is kind of removed and taken away. And you will get depressed, right? You will feel terrible. The purpose of life is no longer there. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to do because everything is satisfied straight away. The Buddha himself says that we sometimes take craving to be a self, right? We identify with craving so much that this is actually who you see yourself to be. And the same thing with the doing. Doing and craving are very closely related to each other. We identify with the doing. We are the doer. We are the person who goes out into the world and does stuff, right? So many people identify with the doer. I've seen so many people, and that's often why you can't meditate, because as soon as you sit still, you kind of start to disappear, right? This is one of the problems with identifying too much with the doing here. So it is really, it is a nightmare. It is, I think, for the majority of people, it would be absolutely terrible to get to the point where everything is satisfied straight away. And yet that is, in a way, what we're striving for. That, in a way, is where our society is pointing to. That is what we're always trying to do. Satisfaction more quickly. Satisfaction more complete. More money. Larger economy. Right? Everything more instantaneous. That is, in a sense, we can probably never actually get there, but at least we're heading in that direction. We're heading towards a nightmare rather than real sense of freedom. Right? Whoa. This is kind of weird. I'm glad we have Buddhism. If we didn't have Buddhism, it would be terrible to see that, because you actually realize that this is not working out. But it's even worse than that, because I think what happens when that craving and that doing is taken away, and suddenly everything instantaneously is satisfied, you realize suddenly that you feel very incomplete. You feel that there's something lacking in your life, right? And this is the problem, is that we, as long as we crave, as long as we are moving towards something that we feel will give us satisfaction, we never really have time, or at least not as much time, to feel that something is lacking inside of us. But once everything is satisfied straight away, that sense that there is something missing, something not there, becomes very, very powerful. This is what life is about, right? We're trying to always satisfy ourselves. Find a sense of completion, find a sense of fulfillment by following the craving. And then one day we take away the gap between the result of that craving and where we want to go, where we want to go and where we are. We take that away and we realize that getting those external objects 100% satisfied straight away does not fill that gap, that hole, that emptiness inside of us, which is always there. It cannot fill up that emptiness, right? And suddenly, your feeling of emptiness, your feeling of lack of meaning becomes incredibly strong and incredibly profound. And you understand that you're never going to be able to find completion, find satisfaction by searching for it externally. There's no way. That becomes so obvious when everything is satisfied straight away. And this is one of the this is a great insight, right? Because that makes you start to turn around and you start to see that actually to feel fulfilled, to feel complete, to feel a sense of satisfaction, I'm going to have to do something else. It's not going to happen through external things. It will only happen if I develop myself internally. And this is one of, one of the great distinctions here between the freedom of the ordinary world and the freedom in Buddhism. And this is the distinction that freedom in the ordinary world is always about external things. But being able to get those external things as soon as possible and as completely as possible, whatever it is, in whether it's relationships or jobs or artistic expression or just sensual enjoyment in general. And then the Buddhist way is actually seeing the emptiness of that, the hollowness of that, how you can actually never get there, and then starting to look for those things in a different area inside instead. So Buddhism is about seeking for that freedom inside rather than seeking for the freedom outside. And that, I think, is the main distinction between the two. But before I talk a little bit more perhaps about the Buddhist idea, I want to talk about another aspect of this as well. And that is the aspect that if we are always searching for things, we want to use our choice to express our will. One of the interesting things to contemplate is, well, okay, so we want to have freedom of will, right? Freedom of choice. But how free is that choice in the first place? Do we really have free choice? Or do we have a freedom of will? How free are these things? And if you start to contemplate this, and I think this is one of those nice things to contemplate if you are into meditation practice and you are into spiritual growth, is to look at yourself. Whenever you choose something, whenever you decide something in life, where does that decision come from? Does it come from you? Is it a free choice? Or is it a choice that is heavily conditioned by all sorts of things? And if you look at that, you will discover very quickly that any choice you make, any use of the will that you make in this life is so conditioned, right? It is so heavily influenced by all these other things. What you choose to have for breakfast in the morning or to eat at any time is conditioned by the past, by what you thought was nice in the past. Sometimes you're not even interested in new stuff because you don't know what it is, so you just kind of pass it by, right? This is what I've been learned to eat. Perhaps since you were a child, you've eaten this, right? And whenever I go back to Norway to visit my family, I get onto the Norwegian food, right? Even though I haven't eaten Norwegian food for 20 years, I'm absolutely sure that this Norwegian food is going to be delicious, right? Nice things like pickled herring. You like pickled herring? This is the kind of stuff that I get into when I go back to Norway. Pickled herring sounds very nasty for other people, but to me, it sounds really delicious and nice. So, and this is it, right? We are so conditioned. We are so completely conditioned by the external environment. What do we do in life? What do we study? I remember when I was 18 or 19, I had to decide what I was going to study at university. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And maybe it was kind of in the cards I was going to become a monk anyway. So what's the point, you know, choosing a particular education if you're going to become a monk? It just kind of seems all perhaps not so important. But the reason I chose to study what I chose to study was because my father said, oh, I went to this university. This is a good university. Why don't you go there? I said, okay, whatever, I'll go there. Right? I mean, you can't get more conditioned than that, right? This is kind of absolute conditioning here. And so it is. So it goes on and on. Our religion, our life, where we live, our house, everything almost we do. Your mental life, your thinking, right? Where does the thinking come from? Start to analyze your thinking. And you will start to see that too. It's just so heavily conditioned as well from all kinds of things in the past. And one of the interesting things that condition us, which I find very fascinating, is that we're not just conditioned by things in this life, but we are conditioned by things in the past lives as well. Right? Many of the things you may not understand. It was like, for me, for example, why did I become a Buddhist? Why did I become a Buddhist monk? And I can't really explain that from the present life. I remember when I was in my early 20s, I wanted to go to Asia. And I had a chance to go as an exchange student to Asia. But why did I want to go to Asia? I didn't have any Asian friends, right? I wasn't really interested in Buddhism at the time. And of course, as soon as I went to Asia, I went to Japan, actually, at that time. This was in the mid-1980s. I went to Japan, and straight away, I went to all the Buddhist temples, right? And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And then I got my first kind of book about Buddhism, and I read that, right? And again, found that interesting, fascinating. And when I got back from that holiday overseas, one of my best friends, he said, well, here is a book you should read. And it was a book about meditation practice, right? It was called The Calm Technique. That was the name of the book. And it was about breath meditation. Basically the same thing as Ram teaches in the present, right here and right now. And I started doing that, and I had some nice results. And it's gradually, you move in that direction. Eventually you become a monk. Where does it come from? I can't explain where it comes from. I think it's very obvious that I must have been a Buddhist in a past life. Otherwise, I cannot explain what is going on in my life at all. There's no explanation. It's just completely weird. And the same thing goes for, I think, many of the other monks in the monastery as well. And this is... it's both interesting, but also it is a bit concerning. Why is it that sometimes I get angry about stupid things in life, right? Sometimes the same kind of thing makes me angry or upset every time. Why is that certain desires keep arising all the time? Why is it that certain delusions, certain stupid thoughts keep popping into my mind? Where does all this stuff come from? And a lot of that stuff comes from the habits that we have carried with us for innumerable lifetimes into the past, right? Going back. And I understood that really for the first time when I spoke to somebody who claimed to have a memory of a past life, and it seemed like a very powerful memory, and he said that that's exactly what happened to him. He saw how his personality had carried on from the past, and that scared him. It scared him incredibly powerfully, because he felt trapped, right? I'm trapped by my personality. I'm trapped by these habits that I created. I can't even see that I created these habits in the past life. I'm trapped by these things. And when I see that, and I walk on my walking path in the monastery, and I feel that something arises in me, some kind of stupid thought, which I wish I didn't have, but you can't wish these thoughts away, right? It just happens, even whether you want to or not sometimes. I probably want to have them. That's the scary thing. So the thoughts are there. They arise, and they come from some kind of unfathomable past, some program that you created many lifetimes ago, and now, like a robot, you keep on repeating the same patterns again and again. And it gives me the sense of urgency. I've got to get out of this. I don't want to be a robot being programmed from some past life, right? And it gives me a sense of aversion towards these thoughts. And I just want to get out of this. I don't want to think like this anymore. I want to turn around and move in a different direction. And this, to me, is a powerful impulse in my practice to remind me that I don't have control over these things. This is stuff that comes from the past, which is now controlling me. I'm not in charge. These things are in charge. I don't want to stand for that. I don't want to have anything to do with that. I want to release myself from these problems. So this is how you can use ideas of past lives, right, of being trapped in the past, to urge you on to say, I must find a solution to this. There must be another way of looking at this. This person I'm upset with, okay, what are their good qualities? They have so many good qualities. Why am I upset with this person? I'm silly. Forget about it. And you change your focus, and you're able to overcome those problems as a consequence of using that kind of reflection. Very powerful. And at the same time, you realize the limit in choice. Choice is incredibly limited because you are basically programmed to a very large extent by the past. Right? So Okay, so we're talking about freedom of choice. Now, if you are programmed from the past, how, you know, kind of the free, whole idea of freedom of choice starts to become quite meaningless, right? If you're just this robot wandering around, it doesn't feel like it, but perhaps you are. Then how important is that freedom of choice? But you can take it even further. And because I, you know, when you understand the... We just wait for the... We're not going to wait for the whole call, so please just... Great, okay. It's very hard to always turn off all the mobile phones, so we have... So that's okay. This is life. So what happens if we look at the Buddha's teachings about how what we are as human beings? What the Buddha says is that when you look inside of yourself, you don't find any self, you don't find a core, you don't find an essence inside of yourself, who you actually are. You are not this one solid, monolithic thing which is always there. What you are right here and right now, you are the sum of causes and conditions from the past, right? This is what you are. All these cause and conditions coming together and making you who you are right here, right now. Now what that means, if that is all you are, these cause and conditions from the past, it means that also your choices is part of you, right? Your will is part of you. Now because everything of what you are is a function of cause and conditions in the past, it means that your will also must be, according to Buddhism, a function of cause and conditions in the past. And there is nothing but these cause and conditions. There isn't anything else. There is no independent entity standing outside of those things and saying, aha, I'm watching all these cause and conditions. Those things watching are also just part of this web of cause and conditions. So what that means, of course, if the choice, the willpower, if that can be fully explained in terms of cause and conditions, and there's nothing apart from that, it must mean that from a Buddhist point of view, there is no freedom of the will, right? Because it is all explained by these other factors. There's nothing apart from these factors. There's nothing standing outside of that that has a perspective. You're fully trapped and fully immersed in these causes and conditions. There cannot be any free will. That's how it seems to me anyway. Some people disagree with that. They say that, you know, Buddhism requires a certain freedom of will. But I personally cannot see that. And anyway, even if there were, you know, a degree of freedom of the will, what I said before, that we are very heavily influenced by cause and conditions, is true regardless. But I take it a step further to say that it cannot. It is kind of follows from all the teachings of Buddhism that there cannot actually be, in the end, any free will. So again, if there is no free will, what does that mean to this Western idea or this modern idea that we should go out and choose things in the world? We should be the agent of our own happiness. We should go out and express ourselves, right? What are we expressing? We are just expressing all these causes and conditions from the past that pushes us in a certain direction. That's all we are expressing here. The reason why this idea of freedom of choice, of freedom of the will, this idea that we're going to express ourselves, the reason why it is so important in the world is because we have a sense of self. And the feeling is that we are expressing ourselves. That is why it is so important, right? Once you take away this idea of a self there, the whole thing kind of collapses. You're not expressing yourself anymore. What you are expressing is conditions and causes from the past. That is not as exciting, right? Okay, so what it means then to have freedom of choice is that you just allow these causes and conditions to flow naturally. That's all it means. But there's nobody there actually expressing themselves. That is what it means. So again, it undermines, Buddhist ideas undermine this whole, you know, this whole thing that we have built up our civilization on, this whole idea of freedom of choice, of expressing ourselves, it is undermined by teachings such as non-self. So what does that mean? Sometimes I think this is very fascinating, and I think, you know, what are the consequences of that? And sometimes, you know, when I say these kind of things, or other monks or other people say these kind of things, people say, okay, that means I can just go back to bed and just lie down and just chill, because there's no sense, there's no free will, right? So there's nothing to be done. So we can just have a good time and not worry about it, because things just happen according to cause and effect. But that is not what it means at all. And that is a complete misunderstanding what lack of freedom of the will means. Because what they are talking about is fatalism, that the whole world is kind of fated to go in a certain way, and regardless of what you do, it will still go in the same way. But that's not the point. The point is rather that the will has an effect. If you do things in the world, there are consequences, so you have to do things. You have to get out there, and the better you practice in accordance with the Buddhist teachings or any teaching or whatever, the faster, the more progress you're going to make on the path, right? So these things have an effect. So you should certainly do your very best to practice in the right way and do the right thing. This is the first thing. It's important to understand that. It doesn't mean that you can just kind of say, okay, nothing matters anymore. That is a wrong understanding of the lack of free will. Because the will has an effect, basically. But the other thing, which I think is just as important, is that for all of us, even though this is very theoretical, right, really, very philosophical, there is no free will. It's really just a construct of the mind. And that is perhaps one reason I don't really like to talk about it so much, because it's just a figment of the imagination in a large sense. It's philosophy without real content. The reality is that it feels like we have free choice, right? When you do something, it feels like you are choosing freely. That is the reality. And that, in a sense, is what is important. And so what you do, instead of saying, I just don't do anything, you say, I will exercise that feeling inside of me of freedom of choice and freedom of the will to do what is good in the world, right? To do what is right. And I will also understand that because I am so conditioned, because I am so influenced by all these external factors, I will ensure that I put in as many causes and conditions as I possibly can. I will put those in place to increase the speed of my practice, right? My practice, my movement on the spiritual path depends on these causes and conditions. How can I put things in place in such a way that it increases the speed by which I progress on this path? That is the right way of thinking, right? And then when you think like that, then you can start to become creative about how to improve your own spiritual practice. And this is one of my favorite sayings in the suttas, in the discourse of the Buddha, where the Buddha says, very famously, that no, the spiritual friendship is not half the spiritual life. Spiritual friendship is everything in the spiritual life. And now you can understand why, right? Because spiritual friendship are the causes. This is the cause and condition which allows the spiritual path to come into practice. The Buddha started all this. The Buddha is a supreme spiritual friend. Other people who practice the path are also spiritual friends. And we kind of move each other forward. And the more we hang out with the right people, the more we are conditioned in the right way, the faster this path will go. So this is one way. If you understand how little personal choice you have, then the more powerful becomes this idea, I need to be in the right environment. I need to do the right things. I need to make sure I'm influenced by all the right conditions, reading the word of the Buddha, understanding what this is about, so I can enhance my practice. Never avoid an opportunity, never miss an opportunity to do good, right? This is so powerful. This is so fundamental to the Buddhist path. And yet, we waste so many opportunities to do what is good. There's opportunities at all times, right, to do good things, to say something nice, to do something good. But then we feel a bit upset. And because we feel upset, we miss the opportunity. But please don't do that. This is so basic, so fundamental. Every time you do something good, every time you do something nice, you're lifting yourself up and you are making meditation possible. If your meditation wasn't very good this evening, it is because, at least in part, because you haven't taken every opportunity in life to do what is good, to do what is right, and to avoid doing bad things. So please, this is the power of goodness. This is the most important aspect of the whole spiritual path, is to practice kindness, goodness, and to avoid the bad things in life. And everything we do in life should be turned into a path of kindness and avoiding the bad. This is how we should think, right? This is so important. And then we move forward. We condition ourselves in the right way. We put all those causes and conditions into place, and things start to happen. So this is how you should think when there is no, if there is no free will, which to me seems the right way of looking at the world. So now I have given you a number of things why I don't think that our modern secular idea of freedom is all that useful at all, right? First of all, it leads to conflict. We go out into the world, we want to enjoy the things that other people enjoy. Conflict is inevitable, right? This is the first thing. The second thing, if you take this kind of society to its logical conclusion, it leads to despair rather than happiness. When everything is instantaneously satisfied, you feel despair, you feel emptiness. There's no purpose to life anymore. Everything is pointless. That is the second reason. And lastly, if there isn't any free will anyway, then what's this big deal about going around and kind of expressing yourself and having all this free will? The whole thing sort of collapses. It is somehow kind of built upon the idea that there is a self. That is what it's built upon. Take that idea away and the whole thing starts to unravel. So what then about the Buddhist idea? If our modern idea, I'm not saying that the modern idea is all stupid. It isn't, of course. There's a lot to be said for freedom from oppression. There's a lot to be said for being able to express oneself and, you know, talk and write openly and all these kind of things. I'm just saying it has very clear limitations, that's all. So what about the Buddhist idea then? And the Buddhist idea is the exact opposite, right? It is, as I was saying before, that we understand that if you want true fulfillment, you need to practice the spiritual path. And as you practice the spiritual path, as you build up the happiness inside, as you reduce the suffering inside, you build up the loving kindness for people around you, for the whole world, the compassion and the peace. And one day you feel complete. One day you feel full. You feel you don't need anything anymore. Why? Because happiness is yours right here, right now. There's nothing more to search for. If there's nothing more to search for, craving comes to an end. You can't crave for anything anymore because there's nothing more to crave. You are complete as you are. You are fulfilled as a human being. In fact, you understand, and this is kind of the point here, you understand that craving is actually the enemy. Because craving takes you away from the state of completeness, right? You sit there, you feel complete, and then suddenly you think, oh, you know, you start craving for something. And then you think, no, I'm actually moving away from a sense of completion. And craving is the enemy. Before, craving was your friend. Craving was a thing that made you choose this way or that way. And now, you come from the other side, you realize that the very thing that made choice possible, the very thing that made this freedom of expression, freedom of choosing possible, this craving, that very thing is actually the problem. So when we talk about freedom in the ordinary world, the freedom of choice, it is a very, very shallow freedom. It's like being in prison, right? You are in prison. Imagine one of those old prisons. You are kind of, you know, fettered to the wall, right, with manacles around your hands and kind of fetters around your legs, right? And then the prison warden comes and says, well, you know, you can choose whether your kind of fetters, whether they are steel or aluminum. And then you say, yeah, give me aluminum, hooray. That is what kind of the choice in the world is about, right? You are already shackled. You're already in prison, and you're allowed to choose kind of the color of the concrete in your cell. Would you like green or would you like blue color in your cell? Oh, yeah, hooray, I can choose my color. No, you are in prison, for goodness sake. That is the real problem, right? Not the color of your cell. And this is kind of the misunderstanding that's going on here. And this is why the Buddhist idea of freedom is so beautiful, and it is so high, and it is so beyond all this kind of stuff that we talk about in the world, in ordinary, that our whole society is built around this idea of freedom of choice. And from a Buddhist point of view, it's complete delusion. It is just about choosing the color in your cell and not really getting out of your cell at all. So you practice the path, and as you practice this path, you feel a sense of completion inside. Craving becomes impossible. Craving is no longer interesting. Craving is your enemy. And eventually, as you go to the end of the path, you eliminate that craving completely. And that is why the end of craving is the highest happiness on the Buddhist path. And there's a nice little story. There's a nice little story in the suttas. I like this little story. There's a monk at the time of the Buddha. He's called Buddhya. And Buddhya, he was a relation of the Buddhas. He was from the Sakyan. The Sakyan family was the Buddha's family. And Buddhya, he was the son of one of the kings, right? So he was very wealthy, and he had everything in life. But then he became a monk, and he meditated. And then one day, after many years, he was sitting in the forest under a tree, cross-legged, right, with closed eyes. And he was just sitting there, and he was just saying, "Aho sukhang, aho sukhang. Oh, what happiness. Oh, what happiness," right? He was sitting there saying that. Imagine coming to Bodhinyana Monastery and you see a monk sitting on a tree saying, "Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss." That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? And then, of course, just as he was saying that, you know, these monks, other monks were walking past, and they were looking at him, wondering, what's going on with this monk? He's saying, you know, "Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss." So they go off to the Buddha and say to the Buddha, "Oh, you know, we saw this monk, Buddhya, he's sitting in the forest saying, 'Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss.' We are absolutely sure that what he is doing, he's sitting there and he's thinking back to the time when he was a prince in the palace, and he was thinking about all the pleasures of palace life. Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss. And now I have to endure this monastic life, sitting under a tree, right? Oh, how sad compared to kind of royalty and kingship and all these kind of things." So the Buddha says, and of course the Buddha understands there's something more to this. The Buddha says, "Okay, bring Venerable Buddhya to me." So he asks, brings Venerable Buddhya, comes, and he asks Venerable Buddhya, says, "Oh, Buddhya, why are you sitting in the forest saying, 'Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss'?" And then Buddhya answers, "Oh, I'm sitting there because I used to think back at all the troubles of being a king, right? All the troubles of that life of being a prince. All the things you have to look after, all the things you have to sort out, all those worldly things. And now I'm free from all that, right? No choices, nothing to do. I'm freed from craving, freed. I've attained the highest bliss, the highest freedom in the world. And of course, that is the freedom of arahantship. And that is why I'm saying, 'Aho sukhang, aho sukhang. Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss.'" And that is the real bliss in Buddhism, when you have the freedom from craving rather than the freedom of craving. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, so any questions? Any comments? Anybody here before we take? Is anything from overseas? Or, there is. Okay. So anybody here want to ask anything before we go from take from over here? Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your talk and for the wonderful meditation. And I just happen to be wearing freedom on my clothing tonight. Yeah. But I feel that I really believe in my Buddha nature, and that I have the freedom to respond or to react when I have anger or someone upsets me. I mean, I still get upset, but it's like I'm not going to react and bring that up, you know, have an unpleasant experience. What I find helps me through my Buddhist practice is I actually chant. I will chant. I bring in loving kindness into that situation, so that next time it happens, it doesn't. I'm not reacting. I'm not. Yeah. It's actually very different.
Yeah.
It's quite miraculous what chanting will do, the power of chanting. Mm. And that helps me. Every day I chant.
Yeah.
And that helps me enormously
yeah.
with my life. So I feel I have the freedom.
Excellent.
I have the freedom
Wonderful.
To do
yeah.
that.
Great, great. No, that's, in a sense, that's what I meant, is basically that we use the freedom that we have, right? And that freedom, from my point of view, is just that the freedom that we feel we have in the deeper sense of the Dhamma, my only point was that to me it looks like an illusion, but the point is that it feels like we have a freedom, and we use that freedom to the best of our ability to do exactly what you're saying here. And this is, you know, this idea of chanting is great. You know, we use basically whatever skillful means work, we use those to kind of to, you know, to, and that is of course one of the great ways of overcoming unwholesome states or whatever, certainly. And that's what I recommend when people do chanting: do it for a purpose, do it for a reason. Don't just do it for, you know, for some kind, because you are used to do it or you've been taught to do it or whatever. Give it some real meaning when you do chanting. Give it a sense of peace, loving kindness, and all the things you're saying. Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Don.
Yeah. Ajahn, all this accumulated conditioning which you mentioned,
yes,
which could also be called the karma,
yeah,
could that be called the self of that person?
First of all, you say it could be called karma, but it's not just karma. Karma is only one type of cause and conditions. There are all other kinds of cause and conditions as well, right? So karma is one thing, and karma is basically about the kind of the ethical actions we did in the past. They have consequences for our feelings now. But then there are all other kinds of cause and conditions as well. Can that be called a self? Well, the whole point here is that the idea of a self. Remember, the Buddha here is talking to a society in which they believe in a permanent core to the human being. This is the Brahmanical society in the day, and it's very similar to Christianity in that sense, and Islam and all the theistic religions are very similar to that. So the Buddha is kind of speaking to that society, and so what he's saying is that this permanence that people believe in, that there is something permanent there, whatever that is the problem, and that is what there is not. And that is what is meant. So you have to define yourself very clearly, first of all. And once you have defined it in that way, then there cannot be a self in that sense, according to the Buddha. If you say that, of course, there is a kind of a self in the sense that there is a, you know, I am separate from you, or you are separate from me, right? We are different. We are kind of different streams of consciousness with different karmic background. We don't really mingle with each other in that sense. In that sense, there is separation. So there is a sense of individuality. That is true. Individuality there is. But you can't really say that it is a self in the Buddhist sense. Yeah. The atta.
Thank you. Just a question in terms of what you were talking about no satisfaction from the craving, you know, from reaching the craving. And I couldn't help but think that there seems to be a lot of people that strive to be rich and wealthy and then get there and then they're miserable.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed,
and
yeah.
There seems to be a lot of that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that a lot of them turn to volunteering and helping others, and then they feel more satisfied, which is what you were talking about.
Right,
as well.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Yeah, indeed, I find it very fascinating that some of the greatest philanthropists in the world are people who are extremely wealthy. People like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, two of the most wealthy people in the world today, and they are carrying other people with them, right? And what they do, they have kind of seen the limit of wealth, obviously. You can't get much more wealthy than that. And then they turn their whole life into giving. Isn't that a wonderful example? I think that it must be some very powerful condition in their life to actually want to give. And I think that probably comes from a past life. That's why they got wealthy in the first place. And then they continue giving in this life, right? You see the thing rolling on like that. So yes, no, I think that is a very important point, and I think that many people also find that if you indulge a lot in sensual pleasures and you have like a really big full of sensual pleasures, maybe a very big high, then afterwards, after it kind of when you've got everything in a sense, you feel kind of empty here. You feel almost depressed, right? If this is what life is about, I have now achieved the pinnacle. There's nothing really there, right? And you feel a sense of emptiness. And this is kind of a known psychological phenomenon, the sense of emptiness or depression that you can have after, you know, sensual pleasures in that sense. So, yes, thank you for that. Thank you for the comment. Okay, thank you. So we have a few questions from overseas. I can just read this. Good. But this is from can you? No, that's too easy. Yeah. This is from Bob in the USA. Can you comment on craving in regard to the Buddha's teaching and the Buddhist path? How should we approach this desire in our lay life? How should you approach desires in your lay life? And well, basically, the most important thing, right, on the Buddhist teachings is to do good, is to live a good life, is to be ethical, to be virtuous, to be moral. That is what really matters. So what you should do in your ordinary life is you should not allow craving, nor anger, nor delusion to stand in the way of doing what is good and doing what is right. This is the most important thing. And so don't worry too much about the craving. You can't really control the craving. If you try to control it, usually you make a mess out of it. But instead, just watch it and be aware of it and be aware of the danger and then sidestep it and then practice what is good and what is right instead. And by doing that, what happens? But if you really get into doing what is good in the world, really get into changing the way you think, right? Having less anger, trying to understand people instead. People don't usually want to be bad. They're just deluded. They're just silly. Well, when I get angry, I think I'm stupid, right? And probably same thing with everybody else. So because of that, you change your attitude. You look at the world in a new way. You look at people in a different way. You become more kind. And as you do that, your own personal sense of satisfaction internally will increase, and that will cause craving to decline. That is where the decline of craving really comes from. That's the most important decline of craving, because you cannot really hold craving in check that much. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. So second one is from Marcus in Germany. If there is no freedom of choice, why is there right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path? Isn't it the requirement for changing habits and awakening here? Well, the reason there is right effort is because when you practice right effort, you're doing the right thing here. So there's still right effort, right? But the question is, why are you doing that effort? You're not necessarily doing that effort because you are choosing it as such, or you are choosing it in a certain way, but not because that choice is entirely free. You're choosing it because you read the Buddha's teachings, and the Buddha's teachings said this is what you must do, and then you have confidence in those teachings, and because you have confidence and they say what you do, you choose that, right? That is how it happens. So this idea that there is the freedom doesn't really come into the picture. What comes into the picture is that you condition yourself in a certain way through the Buddha's teachings, through other wise people, through whatever it is. And in that way, the right effort comes into effect. Right? So don't think, as I said before, that it means you can just sit back and chill. That is not how it works. Okay. Last question. This is from Singapore, Vic in Singapore. How can we choose to be kind and choose to be with good people if all is conditioned? Do we have the free will to do so? You don't need the free will to do so. Don't worry about the free will, right? Just know, you know that it's right to choose that. So you choose that because of that. The Buddha says it's good to be kind. The Buddha says you should do the right thing. So then feel. It feels to you like you have free will. Use that feeling that you have inside of you, that there is free will, to choose the right thing. That is what you should do. right? This is the problem with talking about things too philosophically. It's sometimes very hard to relate to. I'm not sure if I can relate 100% myself to the idea that there is no free will. It's very difficult to really grasp, right? So I talked about that more just to counter the idea that freedom of choice in our society is something very awe-inspiring and wonderful. That's really why I talked about that. But in our ordinary life, in our life as Buddhists, you use the feeling of having freedom. You use the feeling that you can choose. That's what you use. And then you make sure that you put all the cause and conditions into place to support you on that path. And when you put all the cause and conditions into place to support you, it will happen faster because you understand that a large part of it is about causes and conditions. Okay. Anything else? Everybody happy? Eddie? Yeah. Okay. Eddie. Short one, Eddie. Short.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for the wonderful talk. Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah. I also see the Buddhist freedom, you know, from another angle. I equate it with the peace of Nirvana. Remember the Buddha was saying Nirvana is the freedom from the cycle of rebirth, you know, yep, in the 31 planes of existence.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And the Nirvana is the extinguishing, you know, of the negative thoughts and emotions, you know, greed, yep, hatred, delusion, and the accompanying things like anger, ill will, jealousy, think bad on people. Yep. You know, selfishness, sure, all these things, yeah, elimination, you know, extinguishing of, yeah, this fire,
yeah,
and then become,
yeah,
well, exactly, peaceful.
Yeah, yeah.
That's peace.
Yeah, that's all good. And I think actually the most important freedom in Buddhism, which I should have mentioned, which I didn't mention in the talk, is the freedom from suffering, right? That's what really, yep, it is about at the end of the day, freedom from suffering. Yeah. And in ordinary society, we think that freedom from suffering comes through freedom of choice. If we have freedom of choice, we won't suffer so much. But actually, the Buddha says, no, it doesn't work like that. It is freedom from craving. That is what gives rise to freedom from suffering. Yeah, yep, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. So let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.